Welcome to Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide. And today my guest on this podcast is Emmy-nominated television director, writer, producer, animator, story artist, and voice actress Aliki Theophilopoulos. Aliki is best known for her work on the Disney Channel's Phineas and Ferb, Mickey Shorts, and The Descendants' Wicked World series. She began her career on Disney movies including Hercules, Mulan, Fantasia 2000, and many more. Today, she's supervising producer for a new show at DreamWorks. Aliki, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
It is so good to have you here.
Hey.
So, animated cartoons hold a very special place in the hearts of children everywhere, and honestly, millions of adults, too. What made you decide you wanted to create animated stories?
Well, I just loved cartoons from the earliest age. I really can't even remember a time when I didn't love drawing and watching cartoons. I was just mesmerized by them. I loved the way they looked. I loved the way they made me feel. I loved that they made me laugh. I loved that they made me emote. I don't think I really even understood that, but I remember I loved crying when I watched Dumbo and watched the baby mind scene, which I still cry.
We all do.
To this day. Yeah,
we all
exactly.
Do.
And I appreciated the humor and the craziness of cartoons, you know, that were part of the Looney Tunes series or Popeye. But I also loved the sort of, you know, bigger stories that I saw with the Disney films. And I was drawing all the time, I was watching them all the time, and I knew one day I just had to be a part of it somehow.
How did you get started?
Well, I ended up going to USC, and I majored in art. At the time, this is going to date me, but they didn't have an animation program there. They had one animation class. And so I got to USC and I found that animation was kind of a dirty word in the art department. It was much more highbrow and people were more focused on sort of more conceptual type art than drawing cartoons all day.
So it was like commercial and not really art.
Yes, exactly. That wasn't really, I actually, you know, and I don't want to put down USC too much because I actually got a great education there. I feel like I always say USC taught me my thinking. It taught me my analytical skills. It taught me how to think like an artist. They taught me, you know, how to conceptualize. But, you know, I had a teacher that literally I drew something that was kind of cartoon looking, and he was like, I never ever want to see something like that in my class ever.
So
I was like, okay, how am I gonna do that whole cartoon thing then? So I did end up taking this class, which was fun over there, but I met somebody who, it was my senior year, they had just started the graduate program at USC the first year. There was somebody in the class who happened to have an internship at Hanna-Barbera. And being driven enough, I was like, I got to talk to that guy. I got to find out how he got that internship. What do I need to do? And the reason why I met him was because I started hanging out with the graduate kids. I would go crash their class and kind of sit in the back. And so then I talked to him. He told me who I needed to talk to at Hanna-Barbera. I ended up getting their internship there myself. And I was there at an interesting time. It was when the first round of shorts were going on at Hanna-Barbera. And out of those shorts came Powerpuff Girls, Dexter's Laboratory. Gendy was the creator. Fred Seibert was the president at the time, who later launched many more shorts programs. He's a producer behind Adventure Time now. So I was there at this sort of magical time, and also taking even more classes when I graduated, and taking classes helped me connect with teachers in the industry, and I met other people who were pursuing the same dream I was, and just sort of threw myself completely, wholeheartedly into this world. What ended up happening is one of the classes that I took, they had a portfolio night, and you had to be selected to put your portfolio out, and I was one of the people selected. And some recruiters came through. One of them was from Disney Feature Animation. And so I was invited to submit. There was a day, I always like to tell this story because it ended up working out, but there was a day that a bunch of my friends in class got the call that they were getting hired. And I got the call too, and I was all excited to take my phone call. And my phone call was, you're very close, but we weren't quite there. would you take the test to go to Florida? At the time, there was the Florida Animation Studio. Oh. And I was like, I can't move to Florida. I can't leave my family. Okay. And I was just crushed. And then I thought, you know what? I need to be willing to do whatever it takes to pursue my dream. And if that means I go to Florida, I need to not be afraid and just do that. So I said, you know, I called them back and I said, you know what? I will take the test, but I'm going to bring you a new portfolio. And would you mind taking another look? Because I had had this growth spurt since the last portfolio they saw. I put a little note on it. I dropped it off and I got a phone call and they said, you know, we are going to have 4 people be a part of a specialized animation training program. And we want you to be a part of that. So that is how I got my very first animation job at Disney Feature Animation. It was incredible. And after I completed that boot camp, as I like to call it, I was hired onto my first movie, which was Hercules.
Oh my God. So I've just got these full body chills. I've heard several things come out of your mouth that in each case, what made the deciding difference was that you did the extra thing. Right. You know, you were spending extra time outside of the required classes to hang out in the back of the graduate classes, make friends with those guys, learn how to become an intern, get that internship, learn what you learned there, and then like make the extra effort, do the thing that was scary.
Always.
You know, to say, all right, I'm going to go outside of my comfort zone. I'm going to say yes to Florida. And also, I'm going to give them my new portfolio. Like,
right.
All of those things are scary.
Right.
Like, you're putting yourself out on the line over and over and over
right.
again beyond the normal putting yourself out on the line. And in each case, it's what made the difference.
Yes. And it seriously, like that is like a snippet of my 20 years. And it has been a reoccurring theme of constantly facing the fear, going the extra mile, going and shaking the hand of the person I'm terrified of. I mean, I remember, you know, I spent 7 years at Feature Animation and I ended up in television, and there was Fred Seibert, that guy who was the president of Hanna-Barbera, and he just happened to be the executive on the new show I was on, and I was like, oh, there's Fred Seibert, I should go say hi. No, I'm too scared. And then I was like, well, my rule is, and I wish this for everybody listening to this podcast, I ask you to make the same rule for yourself. When I'm afraid, that is the signal that is the exact thing that I have to do always. So when I it's now at the point where I feel fear, I'm like, oh man,
I'm feeling afraid.
Now I have to go do this thing. God. So, you know, I remember that time, like I was afraid, you know, oh, there's Fred Seibert. Oh, I'm so scared. And then I was like, I guess I better go introduce myself, which led to many, many cool opportunities just from that handshake.
That just fills my heart. It's so true. And all of the people that I know who have truly amazing lives, that's like a background
yes.
to their story.
Yes,
something,
absolutely.
Something like that.
Yep.
So did your parents think that you were crazy for wanting to work in animation? Like that's like, I mean, I can just imagine the conversation that might have gone on in your house.
It's such a weird thing. I mean, it really, sometimes I look back at it and I'm like, why did I need to do this so badly? Like, how did I know? It's such a specific thing.
Yeah.
My parents, you know, my parents are both from Greece. They were both born there. My mom left Greece when she was a little bit younger, but my dad, he didn't leave the country until getting a medical scholarship to come to America, which was the first time he had been on a plane.
Oh, wow.
And so for him, his story, you know, growing up very, very poor was, you know, I grew up poor. I studied really hard. I was the top of my class. I got a scholarship. I got to go to America and became a world-renowned scientist. And now I'm giving my children opportunities that I never got to have. And then this weird daughter comes along who's like drawing cartoons and wants to go to USC to make cartoons. Like, what do I do with this? So, you know, definitely there was a blending of they were very lovable and obviously supported me enough to say like, okay, yeah, go up to LA and pursue these dreams, but definitely thought like, this is insane. What is she going to do with this? And I remember there was a moment when I finally got the job at Feature Animation. My parents came and met me for lunch. I was sitting outside with my dad and he was looking around at the campus, which is really beautiful. The Disney Studio campus, as you know.
It's exquisite. It's just amazing. Oh,
it's just a lovely, lovely place. And he looked around and he went, you know what? You did it. with his thick Greek accent, of course. But he's like, this girl, you know, she did it. She went up here. We thought she was crazy. We didn't know what she was doing, but she came up to LA and she had to do this thing, and she didn't have help from anybody, and she came in here and look where she is now. And that was definitely like a huge, huge moment for me. But now, of course, they're very proud.
Of course. Now they see it. That's,
yes.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing to have, you know, something crazy that you really have in your heart that isn't really crazy. It just feels crazy to a lot of other people, maybe.
Well,
you know,
just
have
like,
it just makes
sense.
Yeah.
Like, like, what?
There were a lot of people who thought we were crazy when we came here.
Yeah, I bet.
I know a little bit about how that must have felt.
I'm sure.
So what was it like to be one of the first women in animation? I mean, did it even occur to you when you were, like, just a human being following your passion that, oh my gosh, I might end up being one of the first women in animation?
I mean, it's such an interesting thing to talk about now, looking back. I mean, it's like, you know, along the lines of how you're saying that it was such a strange thing to want to do so badly. It wasn't like all my friends, you know, I was hanging out with my girlfriends and we're all like, yeah, I want to be a cartoonist when I grew up. Like, nobody else was talking about it. Nobody else was doing it. It was just, I was the one that was, you know, into this thing. But I don't think I understood that it was a gender difference at all. It was just, okay, I just love this thing, and my brothers did too. But, you know, I wasn't like, you know, most of the guys, they were like looking at comic books and stuff like that. And I know there are some girls that were into comics growing up, but I wasn't. So it was just this thing that I was the only one I knew who was into it. So cut to being at Feature Animation, again, I didn't understand how few women there were in our industry until I got there. And I started looking around, you know, and realizing that at the time there was a department called the cleanup department, and they were the people who were in charge of taking the very rough animation, which is sort of the soul of the performances, and then making the drawings look uniform and on model so that it looked like the same person drew the whole thing. Otherwise everybody's drawings look so different.
Right.
And I noticed, like, wow, a lot of the women are in this department, but I think there was, like, four animators when I got into the animation department. And so it became something that I noticed. I couldn't not notice it. And then I would be in these rooms, you know, where there would be some kind of meeting about the characters or something we were doing. And again, I'd be like, where are the other women? And I became really good friends with another woman who, she's a director now too, my friend Kat Good, and we became buddies through this whole thing. I mean, we've been friends for 20 years, and we were the two that were like, we've got this thing we want to do, we've got this dream, we're outnumbered, but we're going to do this together. And what I noticed too was, like, you know, I had some amazing mentors that were men at Feature Animation, and I know that I don't think the guys were setting out not to include the girls. I think it's just something that just kind of happened. They're with their buddies and their friends and you know, going to lunches together. And I think many times it was something that wasn't noticed. Now that there's so much awareness about it, I hope and I feel like that it is getting better. I know that there are more female students coming through CalArts and such. Now it's about the women getting into the leadership roles, the creative leadership roles. There are a lot of women producers and such, but the directors and the showrunners and the show creators, like, hearing our point of view and our voice in these creative roles as well.
Yes, and not just doing the cleanup.
Yeah.
We're just basically, like, being relegated to the kitchen, the boardroom. It's like, okay, you're in.
I mean, let's just,
you know.
There's a lot of wonderful male cleanup artists too, but yeah, it just was an interesting thing. I remember one time, at the end of my career at Feature Animation, when I was about to leave and go to television, I was in the elevator with a very high-level person at Disney Feature Animation who I knew sort of peripherally for many years. And it was at the time where they were doing all the layoffs. They were wiping out the 2D animation department, basically. It was a really dark time over there. But he turned to me and he said, so how was your department affected? By the way, I was there for 8 years in the animation department. How was your department affected? And I was like, what department is that? And he's like, well, cleanup. And I'm like, wow. I'm in animation. And yeah, we're affected pretty badly too.
Wow.
It was wild. Wow. It's changed a lot now. But yeah. It's always hard for me to talk about because I don't want to sound like the bleeding heart, like, ugh, it was so hard for us. But it's also wrong to devalue the work that we did at that time and the tough road that we did have to walk to get to where we are and the importance of our paving the way, I hope, for the other gals who are coming up.
It's incredibly important. I mean, it is just so critical, I think, in every field, in every area that one can imagine any human being might want to participate in, to see someone who looks like you.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like Hillary Clinton.
Right.
As a presidential nominee.
Right.
We can just, like, stop right there and not even go forward and say, as president. Let's just say, as nominee. To have a woman be one of the two major party possibilities is like, little girls everywhere, that could be you.
They see
now
it.
It's real. It's not just sort of theoretical.
Absolutely.
You know, and 100%. It's what allows us to imagine that possibility for ourselves.
Completely.
So it's huge.
Huge.
And then animation itself has changed a lot since you got started, right?
Yeah.
The whole computer thing.
Yep.
What was that like to sort of have to navigate?
Definitely took some navigating. You know, another theme I would say in the 20 years is being able to kind of roll with the punches and being able to shape shift and be ready to learn what's new and what the new game plan is.
Yeah.
And not be stuck in a one way of doing things, one way of seeing things. I think the people who get stuck sort of fall out. And the flip side of that is to know your strengths. So when the change was happening, after 8 years of being at Feature Animation, they call us in, we're laying off the whole department, no more 2D animation, most of you guys are going to lose your job unless you make the transition to CG. I did the training in CG. At the time, it was on this computer system, which was, it just felt so dinosaur to me. It was called the Linux and green, you know, wireframes, and it's changed a lot now again, but for me, being a more intuitive creator, it felt so not that for me.
Yeah.
So I did the training and I was like, this doesn't feel right for me. I can't imagine myself doing this. This isn't the deal that I signed up for. So I had to make this choice. Like, am I going to force myself and take a bunch of classes and become the CG animator now? Or if this isn't what's right for me, what am I going to do? And so once again, I jumped into a bunch of classes because I always tell people just take classes because you, even if you take five that are so wrong, the sixth one might be the thing that's right for you. And you meet people and you talk to people.
I love that.
Yeah. So I signed up for a bunch of classes and I took a storyboard class, which I really loved. And at the same, right around the same time, I had a friend who was working for Nickelodeon and he said, you know, one of the heads of the studio told him that they were looking for new talent and he asked me to bring my portfolio by. And I was like, I just have this feature animation portfolio. So he's like, well, bring that by. I brought it to him. And he was like, everything you have in here has nothing to do with what they look for in TV. And so I was lost. I was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do.
That's so scary.
It was so scary. So I happened to be in a character design class. I was doing a bunch of drawings. I brought those to him and he was like, okay, these say more about who you are. He had me bring those to this person that he was talking about and she loved them. And she was like, you know what? You should create a show based on some of these drawings. I love these drawings. And I was like, me create a show? I don't do that. I'm an animator in a corner and that's all I'm going to do. Create a show? Who should think I am? I mean, it was so terrifying. But again, my rule, this head of the studio told me I have to create a show based on these characters I just did 3 days ago. I guess I have to do that. So I did. And I ended up having a choice to make where I could either continue as a 2D animator with one of my favorite, one of the greatest animators of all time. His name's Eric Goldberg. He was going to direct a movie at Warner Brothers. Or I could go to TV animation and become a story assistant, which is the offer I got out of that one meeting, and start this other career that was different than my lifelong dream. My lifelong dream was to animate characters. Now, was I going to continue that in an industry that was changing, or was I going to take this dream and almost shape it into a new dream?
Mm-hmm.
So Eric Goldberg, I asked him what he thought I should do, and he said, go break into television. It was the best advice ever, and it changed my life completely.
I'm hearing a theme of resilience here.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, resilience and, you know, picking yourself back up by those bootstraps time and time again is huge here. I mean, it's since that point on, you know, there have been all the highs and all the, you know, great achievements and all the excitement, and then the huge blows and being knocked down and having to recover and get back on the horse again and move forward. I think it's the genuine love of this thing underneath it all that in the end always gets me going. It always like brings me back up. I love the work. I love the process. I love the people so much. I believe in it so much that even if I get punched in the guts, I'm like, all right. Like my manager always says, you have one day to be mad and sad, and tomorrow it's a new day. You
tomorrow
know?
We roll up our sleeves.
Tough love. Yeah, exactly.
So Phineas and Ferb,
mm-hmm.
Very beloved series.
Yes.
I actually used to watch it with Dove,
who's
a
that's
fan.
So neat.
How did you get involved in that project? How did that work?
Oh, Phineas and Ferb. Oh my God, I loved working on that show so much.
So much heart.
So much heart. And I really feel like it's such a case of the people who are behind the show, both the show creators and the whole crew, who they were as people really bled into the work that we made on every level. And I feel like audiences everywhere felt that. Let's see. I had finished my second short with Fred Seibert, who I spoke about at Nickelodeon, and was looking for what I was going to do next. And my manager actually had submitted my shorts to Disney TV, and Dan and Swampy saw them. And it was really interesting. Again, I was really bummed that my two shorts, neither of them got picked up to series. I was devastated.
So let's back up for a second. So you're asked to create a show,
yes.
Which is scary and confrontational.
Yes.
It takes you way outside your comfort
Beyond.
Zone. And then you go ahead and do it.
Yep.
Which I can't even imagine what that must have taken for you to like create a show.
Yeah.
And then it's not picked up.
Right. And let me just add the storyboard I did for my first short was my first storyboard.
Oh my God.
I had only been a storyboard assistant or a character designer, and all of a sudden it was like, pitch a show, but you have to pitch a storyboard. And I'm like, I've never done a whole storyboard on my own. So I came up with the show, did my first storyboard, and sold it as a short and got to make it. It was incredible. I learned from start to finish how to make a fully animated piece, you know, from beginning to post and all the pieces in between. So I did the two, and it was incredible for that. But then, no, it didn't go to series. But this is the group that, you know, Adventure Time came out of this group, and Fanboy and Chum Chum. And so they didn't get picked up to series, but Dan and Swampy saw them, and they were looking for people on Phineas and Ferb that not only could storyboard, but could write. They wanted to run the show the way SpongeBob is done, actually. It's called outline-driven, which means the show doesn't begin with a script. It begins with an outline. And the outline is then handed to a storyboard team, and they write the script as they're drawing it. So I went from I've done two storyboards my whole life to now I'm going to write the episodes and storyboard them on the show.
Man, you just like surf from adventure to adventure.
Yes.
That's astonishing.
I remember sitting with my best friends at dinner right before I was starting, like, you don't understand. I am going to last 30 days. I'm going to fall so hard on my face. You guys remember this day when I told you how hard I was about to fall at Disney
Television. Circle it on the calendar.
Cuts to run, you know, being there the whole run of the show and having the most, you know, exciting experience of my career. So basically, yes. Yeah, so they loved my shorts, and they felt like I would be able to write and be funny and bring the heart into it and do the storyboarding. But also, I love them for this. They knew that they were going to have girl characters in the show. They wanted the female point of view. They wanted a female voice behind their girl characters. What's wrong with just saying that? Yes, thank you. And I feel like the characters were more authentic for that.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree completely.
For sure.
And obviously that's something that Hollywood is working on right mm-hmm. now, and we are so not there yet.
No.
But at least we're in the conversation.
Yes. I like that people are talking about it. I love in a really productive way, you know, and there's a lot of really awesome men talking about it. I love, yes. you know, to hear, I love when the guys step up and talk about this need and their want to have this voice represented too. It's so, so cool.
It's not a women's issue. It's a human's issue yeah. because we all need to be represented.
Absolutely.
If we want to have stories that really resonate and right. are really powerful.
100%.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah,
yeah,
this is so cool. So you and I, we first met a couple of years ago in a sound booth when my daughter Dove was recording voiceover for your Wicked World series. And I remember talking to you about how animators sometimes incorporate mannerisms and facial expressions of the actors into the animation, because I was sitting there and I was watching Dove do the sound, and I was watching the design
the
and just kind of freaking out because it was like I was watching my kid as a cartoon,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't her, but it was. I was like, how do you do that?
Isn't that cool?
It was wild.
Yeah.
It's still wild to me. I still watch them and I just sort of, my jaw just drops.
Yeah. It's a really neat part of the job. So, you know, animation is really caricature. It's caricature of life and acting and people and how we are, but also how we look and our facial expressions, and our actors are a part of that. It's impossible, I think, to not bring them into what we're doing. For me, you know, being somebody who's really committed to authenticity in my work, it has to be present. So sometimes it's in small ways, sometimes it's in big ways. And in the case with Descendants, you know, when we were designing the characters for Wicked World, you know, we looked at our actors, we looked at parts of who they are, like maybe their eyes or the way their mouths moved. And then we did a kind of caricature of that.
Mm-hmm.
But even more so, I think it just happens once the animation and the acting starts coming to life. And, you know, we often get the vocal track before we're storyboarding even, and we get to listen to the performances and put the nuances of what the actors are doing into our performances. So it's a really great partnership, really, between animator and actor. And it's impossible, I think, to not make what our live-action actor is doing be a part of the drawing part of the process. You know, I remember when I was working on Tarzan, I was mostly on the young Tarzan and baby Tarzan unit, but I often helped out on the Jane unit. And I got to sit in one time, we were watching some B-roll of Minnie Driver.
It was Minnie Driver.
Yeah, it was Minnie Driver doing her performance as she was just doing the VO performance. And Minnie has this way of talking where she kind of makes these kind of crooked mouths. It's a really fun way, the way she speaks.
It's distinctive.
It's very distinctive. And that kind of character stuff, we love it. It just, like, that's the kind of stuff I get excited about when I'm watching people. I'm like, look at that way they always sit. Well, they always, that person always sits that one way with their arm over their head, slung over, and da da da. Or this person always starts blinking when they get really excited. And we like to incorporate that stuff to make our characters more authentic. So, you know, the animators put those kind of fun mouth shapes into the performances of the Jane character in Tarzan. If you go back and you watch it, you will see that fun stuff that she's doing with her mouth
in the
animation.
I've noticed that over and over again when there's an actor that is well known enough that I know
right.
who they are, and I've seen them do,
you
know,
like Dorian Finding Nemo. That looks like Ellen,
totally,
right?
Totally
yeah.
does.
Yeah. Even though it's a fish, it's an Ellen
fish. It's a fish, but it's like yeah. Ellen as a fish.
Right.
It's like, how do you do that, Ellen as a fish? Well, you guys somehow do that.
Yes. It's again, you know, animators are constantly observing everything all the time. And, you know, you might see us out with our sketchbooks, you know, drawing from life, or there's something that might happen for me with my kids that ends up in my work that isn't necessarily completely connected, but the way my daughter smiles when she gives me a hug ends up in the way I draw
mm-hmm.
this little girl character at work one day. Or when I'm feeling sad, you know, I can connect to that feeling in a character that might be sad and that I'm drawing. It's it's really drawing from life constantly.
I so love that you brought that up, because I think that all great art is about noticing what it feels to be alive and finding a way to convey that, you know, and that is part of what we love and respond to about the best animation, like the Dumbo moments that you brought up at the beginning of our conversation. It's like, there's a reason that that is a timeless piece of work, because it affects our hearts.
Right. And I'm like, I always say, like, I'm a connection junkie.
Yes.
I love connecting. I love creating connections. I love thinking about, you know, how can I make this character connect even more in the scene to the audience? How can I get the connection that this character is evil, but I want them to still be likable? How can I create that? And that's the same thing with my friendships or my relationships or my kids or my family. Like, I'm really interested in connections, whether it's in animation or in live action or in art or poetry, whatever it is. I'm always really, really aware of that. I just love that we have these ways of expressing ourselves that bring human beings together, that we bring, you know, the human experience into one. And it's amazing to me. It just gets me excited.
I think my theory has always been that people fall in love with actors because the actors make them feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because the actors are in the position of being in the art, you know,
yes.
But it's really the art that makes us feel something, you know, and the actors are expressing that directly.
And our animated characters have to do the exact same thing. I mean, our animated characters are the stand-in actors. So if they're just standing there still and all that's happening is their mouth is moving and they're blinking a couple times, how do we know how they feel about this thing that they're saying? And how are we supposed to feel about it? We can't just only rely on the actor's performance, the voiceover actor's performance. We're supposed to be building on each other's work. So if we don't have our live action actor to look at, we need to give those facial expressions and those mannerisms to our drawings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And know how to do that.
Exactly.
So what's your favorite part about what you do?
I mean, there's so many. I love the process of creativity. I love how we start with nothing. We just start with blank, and all of a sudden there's life. I mean, it boggles me all the time. I used to think with every episode in Phineas and Ferb, we'd finish one and then start on Monday, you know, and I'd be like, okay, right now there's nothing, and at the end of a few weeks, there's going to be something.
Yeah.
So that sort of magic of what happens there, you know, I talked about how much I love the people. But at the end of the day, it's the why we do this, connecting with people all over the world, connecting with children, connecting with families, bringing families together. I mean, the most rewarding part of it to me is when a kid comes up to me and they know all the words to Finnadroids and Ferbots, which was the first song I wrote for Phineas and Ferb. Or, you know, we have literally had, you know, letters sent to us with, a child who is sick and is going through chemo, and they have comfort when they have their Perry the Platypus blanket. And, you know, to see the effects of the work that we do worldwide, how it gets into people's hearts, the way it's in my heart, is phenomenal to me. That being creative and being passionate about storytelling and connecting can bleed all across the world and bring this love for what we do into people's homes. I mean, it's beyond. It's amazing.
It is beyond.
Yeah.
It is beyond.
I mean, Descendants too. I was just in Greece, and Descendants is so, so popular out there. It's so cool. And they know, you know, the songs, and they love the characters, and to see kids dressing up and you know, on Halloween. I mean, my daughter was Mal last year for Halloween, and so were half her friends, you know. It's incredible.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
It is just the craziest, most beautiful privilege to be able to be part of something that connects us all
in such a
great way.
Yeah, yeah. It's so magical.
Oh, it is magical. And what you had to say about creating something from nothing, that's also been something that's just been a huge theme in our lives, too. It's magic.
Yes.
Now, you did a wonderful, amazing TEDx talk.
Oh, thank you.
Athens. It was so cool. I've watched it a couple of times now because I just really, really enjoyed it. And for those of you listening out there, it's available on YouTube, and I'm going to have the connection in the show notes, but you can also just look up, you could probably just look up Aleke and TEDx.
Yeah, you'll find it. There's not a lot of Alekes out there giving TED Talk.
So link in the show notes just in case, but you can find it on your own too. I found your TEDx talk really moving, and especially near the end where you talked about what it's meant to you to be the only woman in the room. And we talked about this a little bit. But the surprising effect that this has had on you being a parent. And like, I know in my life, you know, there are certain things that have affected me as a parent that I wouldn't have necessarily predicted, like life experiences that then like imprinted themselves on the choices I made as a parent. And you talk about that a little bit in your TEDx talk. You want to broach that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's been really, really interesting to, you know, have this 20 years in my industry, and then now have a daughter, and to watch her, you know, her awareness about, you know, she'll be watching an animated show and she'll say, "Mommy, how come there's only one girl character?" Or, "Mommy, I noticed the girl character is kind of boring. She's not doing," she says this, I'm not even prompting it, but she's noticing it. "She's not saying anything funny and she's not talking that much. And she da 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 da." And one time, my son had gotten a bunch of superhero PJs, and she's like, "I want some PJs about a character that saves the day." And I was like, oh my God, she doesn't have, her PJs don't have characters that save the day. And we got on and we, you know, it was really hard to find, you know, the girl superhero stuff. But just seeing that she was being affected by this and that she was noticing this, and then I was in a position that I could make a difference, not only in my own house, but in my industry, that I have a voice that can be heard and that I can affect little girls everywhere and little boys too.
Yeah.
Let's hope, because I do have to, I have to have these conversations with my son all the time too.
Yeah.
But you know, we were in the store one time and there was a bunch of Cars toys and she's like, "I can only find one girl." So it started really bothering me seeing that affect her. So then for me, it just became having a conversation with her and saying, you know, "Mommy's really trying to make a difference with this." And we would talk about it all the time. But it worried me because I realized how a little girl's self-esteem really could be affected if she's not being represented. And just having the girl one and the personality being the girl one.
Yeah.
Isn't enough.
Like, here, we did it. We checked
that
off.
We did it. We put a girl in there, so we're done with the girl one. Personality zero.
It's done.
She does nothing. She doesn't there. Get the punchline. She has no action. She has no active anything.
No.
And, you know, I love that, you know, Phineas and Ferb was different with this. And by the way, I like to always say this. People often think when we talk about this that that means the girl character needs to wield a sword and be a boy. And it's great if she wields a sword. I'm really happy to see that, too. But I don't want to cancel out what's wonderful about being a girl.
Yeah.
My whole mission is to be able to also celebrate girls, different kinds of girls.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wanted to do Descendants: Wicked World so badly. I was like, "Whoa, this is a show about these distinctly different girl characters that, you know,
Mal and Evie
are totally different. And so is Audrey. Mm-hmm. And then our new characters that we got to introduce, Allie and Jordan. I mean, there were such different girls and it was, I mean, they were shorts. We didn't have a lot of time to completely develop them in a short format, but to put these little pieces in there of, you know, here are these girls, they're different and let's celebrate that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? One of them might like makeup. We're not going to apologize for that. But she's using science and chemical compounds to create the stuff, you
That's
know?
That's right.
They're smart and they're girly. Wow.
Amazing. Crazy.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, bringing it back to my daughter, you know, I had this moment with her and I talked about it in the TED Talk where it was a really moving experience for me where she said, "I don't want to play softball. I want to play baseball like my son." And I was like, "Okay, baby, you can do whatever you want to do." And we brought her out to go to the tryouts. And all of a sudden, she was terrified because she was the only girl there. And hearing the things that came up for her, it was heartbreaking. She said, "What if nobody likes me because I'm the only girl?" I mean, this is in a home with a mother who has these conversations, who's really working hard to change this dialogue and help her in this in this way, say to me, what if they don't like me because I'm the only girl? What if none of the dads cheer for me because I'm the only girl? What if they don't want me on the team because I'm the only girl? What if I don't do a good job because I'm the only girl? She was saying this stuff to me, and I was fighting tears.
Yeah.
And the thing that blew me away, this is what I think is different between her and maybe myself when I was a little girl. I think because there's so much strength in our conversations that we have now with our little girls, despite the fact that she was so afraid, she was like, okay, I'm going to do it, mommy. Here I go. And she went out and did it. She blew me away. She went out with tears coming down her face, struck out, ran around the bases. She got hit by the ball trying to catch it. I mean, everything went wrong. But she never quit. She never left the field. She never ran into my arms crying. I mean, she stayed through the whole thing and then came to me and was like, was it okay? Did I do okay? I'm like, I'm so proud of you, of course. And she played on the team. She ended up doing great. She started from zero and she knew nothing, and she grew on that team and she ended up, you know, having friends, but she had to deal with a lot. She would go up to bat and there were boys on the other team that would say, ugh, it's the girl one. Clearly this hasn't changed enough. Mm-hmm. But I really think that there's enough awareness that we're getting to have those different conversations in our home. And I have to say, my son said, I said, Ruby, you were so strong for going out there and doing it. I'm so proud of you. And she goes, I didn't do a good job though, mommy, because I was scared. And my son said, no, you were brave because you did it anyway.
Yes.
My little guy said that. And that made me feel like not only am I getting to make a difference with my daughter, but my son too.
Oh yeah, he's taking notes.
Totally. It was an amazing moment. So it's like, I feel like it's such a mission of mine in my own home, but in the work. And getting to have the honor of getting to have a voice in this industry that's geared towards children, I am so lucky that I get to make a difference in this arena. And I have to say, the new show that I'm working on at DreamWorks does big time, and I'm super excited about that.
Well, I know you can't really talk very much about that. Is there anything else you can or that you want to say about that? Or
yes, I can't say what it is, of course. I can say that it will be dropping on Netflix towards the end of 2017. So I was in the position after I'd finished Descendants Wicked World, which you know how much I loved working on that.
It's a beautiful project.
With your daughter.
She loves working with
you.
Oh,
I love her. She's amazing. But I was faced with this moment where I had the option to continue on Descendants Wicked World and to do a season two, which nothing would have excited me more. I love the whole franchise and everybody involved. But I also all of a sudden found myself with all these other offers. And I had come to the end of my contract at Disney TV, and truly I was like, I would never even look for anything else because I love Disney so much and I love the project so much. But the stuff was coming my way, and I thought, you know what, it's probably good to at least meet people, you know, always take the meeting. I always tell people, I'm sure you know that too.
Yes, good advice. Yes. Always take the meeting.
Always take the meeting. You don't know when the people that you meet, look at Fred Seibert, who way back when I was 22, you know, the president of Hanna-Barbera, and how I ended up knowing him later. We all circle around each other in our industry. So
yes.
I took these meetings, and I was faced with the option to move on to do season two in Descendants and stay with Disney, which I love, we all know, or these three other opportunities that were incredible opportunities. They all four of them were, and I was a mess trying to make this decision, and I almost couldn't talk about it with people because people are like, this is a quality problem. You're grossing me out. You know, it's like, ugh.
I don't want to hear about
it. You don't understand. I'm in hell. I'm in turmoil. I don't know what to do. And when I had to make the decision, it was right at the very moment where I was stepping on the plane to go give my TED Talk. And the theme of my TED Talk really came down to being authentic in your work and being authentic in your life and how that all sort of bleeds together. And I said to myself, how can I be here giving this talk to 1,500 people in the Palace Theater and to speak about being authentic after 20 years in this industry and not go back home and make the choice that is the most authentic for me. If I'm going to talk about this, and if I'm going to say that I'm in a point in my life where I want to align every aspect into this theme of wanting to be authentic, I need to do that with my work too. And so I knew which one I had to pick. And that meant A, facing a fear, again, like I've spoken about. I was terrified to leave Disney after being there so long and really having a family there, and going to this new studio, and all of a sudden having to work with new people and proving myself again in a way, because it wasn't with people that already knew me. But I believed in this project, and the project offered an opportunity to have a voice in the way of, like I said, how I've been speaking about throughout this podcast, speaking to the audience and that I want to speak to, and creating something that there's a real need for still in our industry, in a way that's so special, that is so exciting for me, that it just became that there was no other choice, that this was the one I had to do.
It called to you.
It did. It called to me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I just was like, I need to draw this. I need to do this. I need to be a part of it. It's scary, but this is the one. This is the right choice.
And that's how you know.
Yeah, exactly. As you know.
As I do. As you know. That's how we ended up down here.
Yes, yes. As we, this is why we're sitting across from each other right now. I know that. Yes. And you know what? The more you talk to people, as I'm sure you found, every time I talk to people who are a part of some sort of creative endeavor, and maybe beyond that, you know, when I talk to my dad about his path at becoming a scientist, it's similar.
Yeah.
We all go through these kind of same things, and we have to have this sort of, you know, the resilience, the willing to face the fears, the willing to take risks, the falling on your face but picking yourself back up, the sticking to your truth, that, you know, when you sort of make these themes a part of who you are, success finds you.
Right? It's kind of hero's adventure,
right?
Stuff.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Joseph Campbell stuff.
Yes.
Yes. Love, 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 love. Yeah.
Love him. I gotta listen to all those tapes
again.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Tapes. Me too. I have the tapes too. Oh my God. We're not really that old, you guys. We're actually like in our 20s, right?
We meant MP3s. Oh man. Well, what advice would you have for young artists who might want to do what you do? Like there is a whole bunch of younger people now who they've grown up and they've seen this as a possibility and they're in love with that art form. Mm. What would you tell them to consider doing in terms of their path, how to get from where they are to where they hope to go? Mm.
There's sort of different pieces of it. I think one part of course, is if you've hopefully made it this far, is the themes of what we've been talking about here of, you know, when you have the fear to face that fear and to, you know, when you get knocked down, to pick yourself back up and try again and to throw yourself into the extra. You know, recently I actually did a panel with Dan Povenmeyer, and he was saying, he pointed out, you know, all the people on this panel have one thing in common. We've all gone the extra mile. None of us did just enough to get by and then waited for somebody to do something for us.
Or notice you.
No. And we all went the extra mile and worked really hard and put the late hours in. And I mean, I remember in my 20s, like, people were going out and doing all this stuff. And I'm not saying don't have fun and live your life. In fact, I always talk about Glenn Keane saying the only way to animate life is to live one. However, I made a lot of sacrifices to focus on my craft. And there were many times I was working late on this thing or the other, trying to get better, when my friends might have been going out and doing something that sounded more fun maybe than working. So that's a big part of it. And then a whole other part that I think is really important is the younger people coming up, they have something that I didn't have, that we didn't have. They have access to information in a way that was impossible for us. They have everything on the internet. And one thing that I find for me that's really frustrating is I think that sometimes the younger generation think that that means access to people. And
wow.
It's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not fair to get on Instagram and start demanding that we give them jobs.
Yes, I've seen that.
I've seen it so much. And it's really, I've actually seen people get really entitled and angry, and it puts me off so much. It's so frustrating. And I think I didn't have this. And also, when I was lucky enough to meet somebody, or somebody would introduce me to somebody that could possibly help me, it was really important to have an attitude of respect and patience, and, you know, and
humility, maybe.
Humility. And I know this is like not as fun and juicy thing to talk about as the other stuff, but I think it's really, really important. I have had people email me out of the blue or send me Instagram messages or whatever, and they've been really, really rude and really demanding. And I think you have everything at your fingertips. You can get online classes. You can listen to podcasts. You can see tutorials online. People are posting their drawings on Instagram and on Twitter. There's blogs and Tumblr and all this stuff. They have everything. When we wanted to find out, you know, who Mary Blair was, we had to go find books in old bookstores. When we wanted The Illusion of Life, which is like the Bible for animation, it wasn't even in print. We had to borrow it from people, make photocopies. You guys have all that now. And when you're at the point, I'm not saying not to reach out to people and mentors, because mentorship is very, very important. But when you find yourself in that place, it's so important to take it on yourself. Like, you do the work. You work on your craft. You go and do what it takes to become good.
Yeah. Do the homework.
So that when you have that moment to meet that person, you have the goods. You can be respectful of their time and that they're taking to even talk to you. And I will tell you, that will move mountains. I have had people that have approached me cold, but their letter was so respectful, and I could see that they did the work ahead of time, and their materials were so well put together. They had a website, they showed me their blog or whatever. And then when I get hundreds of emails a day at work and I can barely keep up and then see my children, they are so respectful of my time. They will send me a follow-up email. I know you're really busy. I am so appreciative that you took the time to take a look at my work. I will make time for them. I will meet with them. I will have them come to work. I will look at their portfolios. I do that kind of stuff. But when it's rude or entitled, or I can see their work isn't there at all, I'm like, I go and get it started on your own with all the stuff that you have access to. Then we can have a conversation.
This is the most brilliant gift, what you just said right now. And it's honestly, I'm really grateful that you said it, because what you're talking about applies to any field.
Everything.
It's not about animation. It's about anything that you want to do. Mentorship is important.
Right.
But regardless of the subject matter, you need to do your homework and be as prepared as you can before you approach these people who've put in decades,
yes,
usually, and are probably at the top of their game,
right,
you know, so that you don't blow that shot.
Yes.
Because the stakes are high, you know, to have the possibility of working with somebody who might make all the difference to your career.
Right.
To take you under their wing or not.
Yes.
Because you,
yep,
weren't, you know,
you
approaching
didn't have
it right.
An attitude that was professional,
yeah,
and respectful.
Yeah, so,
and that's
so
part of the job, guys.
Do it right.
When you get in, and you might have amazing work, and you get into the door, you get your foot in the door in whatever field that may be, and then you're going to have bosses and you're going to have people above you. And if you can't have that attitude of respect and humility and going the extra mile and all these things that we're talking about at work, you're not going to get too far. People aren't going to want to work with you again. So, you know, it's like I said, it's kind of like the not fun part to talk about, but it's so, so important, and it will take you so very far if you can grasp this concept.
It's so true. I mean, again, in any area of any industry that I can think of, but especially the entertainment industry,
mm-hmm,
which is what I'm always talking about on this podcast, there's a zillion talented people. Talent is not in short supply.
No.
Talent is everywhere. Especially in these concentrated areas like Los Angeles,
mm-hmm,
or New York. And so after a certain point, talent's just a given. But then what makes the difference?
We work with people we like at the end of the day. Yeah.
It's the people that you want to see in the morning.
Right.
And
spend
work with
those
all day
hours. Yep.
And stay late at night to finish the project with.
Absolutely.
The good people skills.
100%. And I love working with Deb Cameron.
Well, like I said,
she
loves
delightful.
Working with you.
She's delightful.
And so are you, Aliki. What a great pleasure.
So are you. You're such a gem. I'm so glad we got to meet. Through Doug.
I know.
I am so glad we got to meet. And I have to say, I'm so impressed with what you're doing and how you found, I mean, you're doing all the things that we talk about. Like you know your voice, you know what you have to say and your sort of sweet spot in this universe and who you have to talk to. And you're doing that in such a cool, exciting way. And I'm always really inspired and impressed when I see people doing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been fun. I've got my own hero's adventure going
on here. That's awesome. Yes.
Well, so thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Yay.
So everybody who's listening, I want you to track down Aliki. Follow her. She's amazing. On Twitter, she's Aliki Greeky.
Yep.
That's AlikiGreeky. Same on Instagram. And your website, which is really cool.
Oh, thank you.
I love your website.
Thank you.
Oh,
it's kind of got a bit of everything on there.
Yeah. Like so much more stuff than I was even aware of that you do. It's AlikiGreeky.com. And then I really recommend that you look up her TED Talk. It's An Animated Life at TEDx Athens.
Yay.
Thanks, Aliki.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, subscribe to this free podcast and leave a quick rating and review. A moment to click on a star rating really helps, and a minute to write a sentence-long review makes a real difference in the ranking for this podcast. Thank you so much for helping me. Do you want to know more about getting a young actor up and running in Hollywood? Buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And if you need specific help getting your career or your child's career up and running or to the next level, you can get a one-on-one consultation with me over Skype or in person in Los Angeles. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the consultations page. Thanks, and see you next week.